Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Min Chen. Antoine Van Ockmel was the founder and CEO of the investment management firm Emerging Markets Management and now serves as a senior advisor at the Foreign Policy Group. His work analyzes how emerging markets across the globe grow and talks about how the West could respond to the challenges they bring. He and Fred Backer co-authored the book The Smartest Places on Earth, Why Rust Belts Are the Emerging Hotspots of Global Innovation. Antoine Van Ockmel, welcome to Take Note.
Delighted to be here.
In your book, The Smartest Places on Earth, you describe this idea that a lot of innovative cities across the U.S. and Europe are once again re-emerging and kind of bringing a new level of competition. Where did this idea come from?
Yeah. Well, of course, if we go back in history, these places like Pittsburgh or Akron and others were built on innovation at the time, but they kind of lost it for a while. And during my travels around emerging markets, and we invested $25 billion in these various emerging markets from China to Argentina, I was struck by the fact that when you hear politicians here talk about the United States, it seems that we have kind of lost it, that we have lost our competitive capability and our drive. Whereas if you go and talk to people in China, Taiwan, Korea, they're actually full of admiration and worry about the competition that the United States gives and American companies give, because we are so far ahead when it comes to research.
And many of these cities that you travel to and learn about are former Rust Belt cities.
Yes.
And like you mentioned, there's some sort of connotation, certain kind of connotation to it sometimes. But what kind of characteristics do you see these cities share, and why do you see opportunity in them?
What they share is that, as I said, they were originally built on innovation. But over time, the manufacturing that they did became no longer competitive. And so for a while, they lost their competitive edge, as a result of which the industries moved abroad and things were done where they could be done cheaper. I'll come back to that. The populations declined. The cities downtown started to look terrible. They were no longer vibrant. People moved away. So for a while, things looked very, very grim. In fact, in the United States, we lost 7 million people in manufacturing. That's more than a third of the workforce. So that was huge. Fortunately, that has started to turn around. And it has started to turn around because in some of these rust belts, not all, but in some, in fact, many, about 50 or so of these rust belts all over the United States and another 25 in Europe, what happened was that they had universities that had a unique research capability. They then in turn hooked up with sometimes the old industries, sometimes startups, and started to build something new, which brought in many cases the vibrancy back. Let me give you one specific example. Akron, Ohio, used to have the four big tire companies. Thousands of people worked there. Gone. Now it has over 1,000 little polymer companies that employ more people than these four old tire companies before. And why? Because the University of Akron kept its world-class capability in polymers. Polymers are basically the basis for all plastics, you could say.
And I was going to ask, you call these emerging former Rust Belt cities brain belts. Can you explain that a little bit? And I think it works kind of into the example that you just gave.
Yes. I call those Rust Belts brain belts because what used to matter these last 25 years is how cheap you could make something. That's why in China, there was such a rise in manufacturing. What's going to matter for the next 25 years, and that's what the people in emerging markets were telling me, is how smart you can make something. And so in this new economy, this digital economy, that's where a collaboration between universities, startups, and old industries is becoming key. That collaboration you could call a brain belt.
And one of the examples that you raise in Pennsylvania, you look at how Pittsburgh works with Carnegie Mellon University on robotics and information technology.
And University of Pittsburgh.
Right. And why did this kind of collaboration and partnership become a focus in your examination? And how widespread do you see them happen?
There are really several things. First of all, it is the fact that Carnegie Mellon, for example, is a truly world-class university that had a unique capability, in this case, in robotics. That is one side of the story. The other side of the story is that in the traditional centers of innovation, the two coasts, from Boston to Silicon Valley, things became so expensive, people couldn't afford to live there anymore. And so these big companies started to realize they had to diversify. They had to diversify the places where they worked. And so they migrated some of their workforce to places that had great universities, but where the living was both pleasant and a lot cheaper.
So this kind of affordable housing, I guess one of the things, the affordability of living in these certain cities become kind of a perk?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's important. I often mention that one of the key things that I discovered in these brain belts, these new rust belts that are becoming brain belt, is that they focused on something that, as a Dutchman by origin, is very dear to me, is bicycle path. There seems to be some correlation between innovation and bicycle path.
Really? That's an interesting connection. Wow. You also call these partnership sharing of brain power. And I wonder, how is this kind of open collaboration that you talk about really different than how research or innovation has been done before?
Once I interviewed Shirley Jackson, who is the president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and she told me something I never forgot. She said, innovation today is no longer taking place within academic discipline. It takes place between academic disciplines. That's the difference. When it takes place, when the problems and the issues become so complex that one academic discipline or one company can no longer solve them, then you need collaboration. Then you need collaboration between within universities and between universities and old companies and between universities and startups.
I guess that's one really important characteristic for these cities that you see as well.
Absolutely.
What does it cost to make these collaboration work?
What it takes is, first of all, that you're desperate, that you have your back against the wall, that you don't see any, because people don't change just by themselves. That's one. Number two is that you have a really world-class university that focuses on one particular or more areas of research in which they are truly world-class and is willing to reach out to the local community. Both are important. The third is that you have what I call a connector. And that connector can be, in the case of the University of Akron, it was the university president. In the case of Portland, Oregon, it was Phil Knight of the shoes. In other places, it was an administrator. It can be all kinds of people, but it requires someone who has the vision and the Rolodex and, let's say, the leverage on both people in the university and outside the university to make things happen. Those are, I think, the key issues. In addition to that, it is a recognition that if you want to attract young people that are bright and that are innovative, you need a vibrant atmosphere. You need coffee shops. You need theaters. You need all kinds of things. And finally, of course, you need money.
That's a big one.
Absolutely.
And like you mentioned, today's innovation involves technology very heavily. And we also rely on big data more as well. Yeah. And do you think, like you mentioned, we're facing more complex issues and we do have more tools? Do these tools help accelerate the reemergence of these former Rust Belt cities, or do they make competition more intense because you are trying to take on a bigger piece of an issue?
It's both. Competition is not going to get any easier. Competition is getting smarter. What is not going to happen, I can tell you, is we are not going to bring your father's manufacturing jobs back. Some politicians may dream of that. It is not going to happen. What will happen, I think, is that we're in the and that's what is actually happening in these brain belts, is that we're creating a whole new kind of economy that is kind of a mixture of the old traditional economy and the new economy. It is based on the old industrial expertise, but it uses new production methods like robots. It uses new materials like polymers. It uses new discoveries. And on top of that, it is connected to the digital economy. So it's connected to wireless IT, and it is using big data and artificial intelligence. No wonder that both the United States and China are so focused on artificial intelligence. And finally, all of that is connected through these tiny little chips called sensors. That whole new complex is the new economy that I'm talking about, an economy where everything is connected. Let's say Facebook and Google can figure out every minute of the day where you are, what you're doing, and what you're buying. And if Boeing can see at a desk in Seattle how planes all around the world are flying and what is wrong with them, then you know that you live in a connected economy.
Is there any danger that comes with that?
Of course. There are plenty of dangers. You can be overconfident. Boeing was an example with the 737 MAX. Or you can have hacking. Of course, if everything is connected, that brings its own fragility. What could happen is that with self-driving cars, they get hacked. So there are absolutely cybersecurity, hacking, and other problems.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Antoine Van Octmel. He was the founder and CEO of the investment management firm Emerging Markets Management and now a senior advisor at the Foreign Policy Group. His work analyzes how emerging markets across the globe grow and talks about how the West could respond to the challenges they bring. He's a co-author of the book The Smartest Places on Earth. With traditional industrial fields declining, for many years, like you said, the narrative has been with factories closing, job loss, and many other struggles in Rust Belt cities in the United States and also in other places in the world as well. Your book came out in 2016, quite full of positive outlooks.
Yeah.
Have you seen the narrative change since then?
Absolutely. Don't forget the 2016 elections, where were they won or lost? They were won or lost in the Rust Belts. That is what made the difference. At that point, we were looking at a situation where in manufacturing, we had just lost over the past 20 years, 7 million jobs, a third of the world worth. Things look terrible. Now look at the situation today. We have the lowest unemployment we have ever had. And where is the problem? The problem is not in finding jobs at the moment. The problem is in finding people, finding skills. So things have actually quite dramatically changed in that sense. And I'll make one forecast. In the next presidential election, the Rust Belts will again be a major issue. Again, that will be the place where the battle is fought.
Do you see that more as a positive thing, or do you also worry that politicians not take advantage of, but they're using some sort of desperation that they can see?
Yeah. I think what President Trump did was he understood the anger of people who felt left behind by competition and globalization and by automation. He understood that and played into it.
But do you think there should be a new narrative about it just because, you know, what you're advocating is let's embrace competition, let's make things better, let's bring the Rust Belt, not necessarily back to its old glory, but make something new out of it.
Yeah, it create a new glory instead of let's bring it back to the old glory. Let's focus the future not just on the two coasts, but let's focus them also on what's in the middle. There are plenty of other places out there, rust belts that can be turned into brain belt if you basically have universities, startups, and old industries work together. If you don't do that, you're toast.
I want to know more about, you know, what does it take, because it does feel like there are a lot of factors that get into play. How could Rust Belt cities be sure that they have the right ingredients to do these things if they want to?
The fact is that you're never sure. My mother always said, the no you have, the yes you can get. You have to try. And not all of these efforts will succeed. Not every new company is successful. Not every new invention actually leads to something. But one of the things that has to happen is that venture capitalists have to learn that there's a lot of money to be made, not just in social media, but in these new combinations of digital and traditional manufacturing.
One of the main things that you also write about and you have talked about supporting your positive observation is this transition from the West competing with newer markets around the globe on making things cheaper to making things smarter. Can you give an example of, you know, what do you mean? Do you have an example of things that we do well these days because we are trying to make things smarter to compete?
Look at something we all have in our pocket, and that's a smartphone. The smartphone is physically made to a large extent in China. But where is the innovation done? The innovation is done in Silicon Valley. And in fact, most of the profits from that come to Silicon Valley. So that's an example where actually what matters more than the cheapness is the smartness. And you will see that more and more. Take the self-driving car. Who would have thought 10 years ago that we would have a very successful new car company in the United States? This is what people railed against. You know, the Japanese were too competitive. The Europeans were too competitive. But guess who is now outcompeting everyone? Because it was smarter, that's Tesla.
And I hear your optimism, but I can't help but wonder, a lot of the innovative advancement that you find in these new brain belts area, they are cutting edge technologies that haven't seemed to make huge waves or restore the job loss overall we have experienced or turned into very well established industries. They're still at their early age. So can we really be all that optimistic like you are?
I think we can be. Obviously, let's say a baby doesn't grow up in 2 years. It takes time. If you just think, how long ago was it that we had the first smartphone?
2007.
Yeah. So that's 12 years. In 12 years, we have gone from nobody even knowing what a smartphone was to virtually everyone in the world having a smartphone. Is that slow? I would say that's pretty fast. If you look at medicine, how chemotherapy was basically the only thing used for cancer. And if you now look at the huge number of new drugs that are available within a span of 10 years. Now, of course, it takes time to develop them, to test them, to then get them approved and bring them to the market. There's a whole process for that. But if you look at what is in the pipeline at these universities, then yes, I am very optimistic.
And one of the questions that I have in mind is a lot of these examples that we can point to, the very successful examples, they seem pretty concentrated in one handful of companies. What can we expect that these new brain belts could do? Could we expect them to raise all boats?
I think there is a problem, just as there was a problem with globalization, just as there has been a problem with automation, that, as they call it, winners take all. That is a problem. That's a problem that companies cannot solve. That's a problem that governments have to solve. If, let's say, these technologies get too concentrated, those industries need to be broken up. We have antitrust laws for that. If the wealth and the income gets too concentrated, then it's the government job. And of course, the people's job who elect those governments to say, we need to redistribute this. Otherwise, let's say everything will be owned and earned by a tiny group of people. That's not a recipe for, let's say, health of the global economy in the long run. We have to recognize that and do something about it. But it's not something that can be done by companies. It's not something that can be done by universities. That's something that has to be done by governments.
And, well, just like technological innovation, I guess, in politics, it takes time.
Yeah. My own view is that at the national level, in our thinking about what needs to happen in the future, tend to look back rather than to look forward. It's very different at the local level. At the local level, you see this collaboration. You see gridlock in Washington. But in many local places, you see the various parties, both political parties, administrators, companies, and universities work together, collaborate, share brain power, as I call it.
So one of the policy suggestions you make is to develop and support job training programs. And it is a common priority for many areas' economic strategies. But it faces challenges, of course, including matching skills with the right positions. In your vision, what does really successful job training or retraining look like? And what more is needed?
Yeah. First of all, let's remember that we had very good job training in this country. It's not something that never happened here. Then let's also recognize that job training and work-study programs are used in a lot of different places. They're used in Canada, north of our border, quite extensively. They're particularly used in Germany, Scandinavia, Holland, Switzerland. So in a lot of Europe. This is not rocket science. This is being done and being done very successfully in a number of places. But it requires, again, governments and companies to work together. That will doesn't seem to be there as yet. I think that will come now that we know that we have a huge skill gap. We simply don't, I mean, older workers are leaving the workforce, and I describe that in great detail in the book. And the younger workers are not trained to do what is required by a modern economy. Part of that is because of what I call a college obsession in the United States. There's this sense that everyone should go to college. But the truth is that not everybody wants to go to college. Some people are better at other things. And while you have to be careful not to discriminate, and that has often happened, if you organize this well, if you really make community colleges focused on job training, if you do what some companies are already doing across the United States, if you really have these work-study programs, as they have in Germany, you can do something about this skill gap.
I was going to ask, just because higher education has its own very many issues in the United States, do you have, I guess, one example that really stands out to you how this program should work, especially outside of the college scope of things?
Do I have an example of that?
Yeah.
Well, there's for example, I went just north of Albany to one of the semiconductor companies there, and they have a very extensive training program where they recognize that for the people that they were employing there, and they were employing a lot of people, that they actually needed to have everyone who came in needed to have a common base of knowledge. And so they started to do it. They've been quite successful. They've been doing it around Duke in some of the community colleges there in North Carolina. So it is being done, but on a very small scale, could be vastly expanded. And that would be good for everybody.
When we talk about that, when we want to make sure that especially young people in this kind of transformative age get the skills that they need to succeed, what kind of role do you think land-grant universities like Penn State play? And what do you hope to see them do more of?
Well, first of all, many of these universities, Akron is one of them, Penn State is another, but there are many others, were originally designed, they got these land grants to do exactly that. And I think they're beginning to recognize that they should focus again on what they were originally designed to do. That is to give people the skills to deal with the economy in which they live.
Antoine, thank you very much for joining us on Take Note.
I was delighted to come and glad to talk about the smartest places on earth.
Antoine Bennock-Mell was the founder and CEO of the investment management firm Emerging Markets Management and now serves as a senior advisor at the Foreign Policy Group. His work analyzes how emerging markets across the globe grow and talks about how the West could respond to the challenges they bring. He and Fred Backer co-authored the book The Smartest Places on Earth: Why Rust Belts Are the Emerging Hotspots of Global Innovation. You can listen to more Take Note interviews on wpsu.org/take note. I'm Min Chen, WPSU.